What I want to talk to you about this morning is Philippians chapter 2, verse 14. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 14. I think this is a very timely subject in our nation. I'm not just talking about a timely subject for us here, but a timely subject for our nation in general. And the title of the message is No Whining. No Whining. We all know what whining is. Whining is when something you don't like happens and you complain and murmur and grumble and come up with excuses and why is this happening to me? That's kind of what I mean by no whining. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 14, Paul says, do all things without murmurings and disputings. And it's the introduction to the whole next section of this chapter. But I really wanted to slow down, and I think a lot of times, and I've noticed this in a lot of the commentary that I've read on this chapter, they kind of skip over this verse. It's kind of, well, he's just introducing this next big subject that's coming up. And there is. There's a big subject that comes up directly after this verse. And, of course, there's a big subject right before it in verses 12 and 13 where we talked about work ye out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it's God that worketh in you to will and to do of his good pleasure. So there's that big subject. Then there's the big subject that comes right after this, which ties in with that. And there's just this little phrase in the middle that says, do all things without murmurings and disputings. And we don't want to take it completely out of the context, though. This goes right along with what has already been said. If you remember back, we talked about working out our own salvation with fear and trembling and what that means. And that there is a work that we're to do, and we're to be doing good works, and we're to be showing the fruit of that work that God's done in us in our life. Now, we can't do those things in and of ourselves. And we were very clear about that in that message, that when God works salvation in us, then that's worked out in our lives. It's not that we do works and then we merit salvation. God works in us, and then because he does that, we're able to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling, fear of God. And then he says, do all things without murmuring and disputing. So don't take those two statements apart. As we're working out our own salvation with fear and trembling, we're to do that without murmuring and without complaining, without disputings, without whining, to put it in our modern vernacular. So we're going to talk about this morning, no whining. And another subtitle of this would be living with a dissatisfied contentment. And I know that's a funny phrase, but if you really take it apart, it's not an oxymoron. It's not something that doesn't fit. We need to live with a dissatisfied contentment. And now I'm borrowing that phrase. I want to give him credit from John Piper. I don't agree with everything he says, but sometimes he just hits the nail right on the head. And I think he did with this statement, that we're to live with a dissatisfied contentment. So first I want to look at our culture, because we live in a culture of complaining. We really do, especially in this country. We live in a culture of complaining. We live in a very complaining and discontented society. And it seems to me, and I'll take the blame for this as much as anybody, that it gets worse with every generation. I think my grandparents were much more content than my generation, and it seems to be with every generation getting a little worse. I think a lot of us could look at our grandparents, and especially our great-grandparents, and on back further, and we could see that they were very content with a very little. Most of them, now some of your grandparents may have been mega rich and had everything they wanted. I don't know. But even that being the case, it seems like that this culture of complaining and this discontentment with our lot in life is getting worse and worse with each passing generation. We expect more. Most people now expect that as soon as they get out of college or as soon as they start their job, they buy a really big house. And from day one, they have this big house. And my parents lived in a really tiny little one-bedroom house on a side street in Memphis right after they got out of college and started their life together. And then they moved to a little bit bigger house, and then they moved to a little bit bigger house. And eventually, when I was in the eighth grade, they finally built the house that they always really wanted and got their land and got to where that they are now. But it seems like now people get out, so immediately they want that big house. They want the full thing that their parents have right then, even in their younger years. And so that's just one example of how I think that we're seeing this get worse and worse and worse in our society. And what's really interesting about that is that We live in the most indulged society in the world. There's no doubt about that. If you don't understand that, then you need to, if you can't travel, which a lot of us can't go to these foreign countries, then you need to get on National Geographic or something and look around or get a magazine and read about the world situation. And I'm not just talking about Ethiopia and places like that. I'm talking about places in Europe, places in the Baltic states, and places in Southeast Asia where they don't know whether they're going to have a meal or not, much less all the things that we have. So we live in the most indulged society in the world, and it's probably the most discontented. Now, isn't that amazing that here we are blessed more than any other nation on the face of the earth, and yet probably we are the most discontented and dissatisfied country in the world that we live in. So the more people have, it seems like the more that they're discontented with it. We've all heard that before. The more you have, is that going to bring happiness? No, it just makes you want more. And then you get more, and then more and more, and it never is enough, it seems. Let's turn to Proverbs chapter 15. And usually when you talk about issues like this, Proverbs is a good place to turn, because Proverbs is a book of just practical wisdom. And on an issue like this, I think we could go to many, many places in Proverbs to see verses about this, but I picked Proverbs 15 and verse 16. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 16. Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. It, like we said, it seems the more that people have, the more trouble that happens in their life, and then the more discontented that they get as a result of that. There's been a lot of studies done about people who win the lottery. And what they do is somebody wins the lottery and they go from being just your average middle class or maybe even lower middle class American to all of a sudden having a whole lot of money. And what they'll do is they'll track these people. They'll start right there and start tracking their life and see what happens over a 5 and then a 10 year period. And it is absolutely amazing that in most cases, over 75% of the cases, they end up going to a level that they are lower than they were before. They blow all the money, and they're not happy, and usually drugs become involved and all other kind of things involved, and it affects their children, and it just ends up being a scourge on their life in the end. So we see that it is better to have little with the fear of the Lord. Now, does that mean that it's wrong to have a lot of money? Absolutely not. It's not. But it makes it harder for you to really lean on God and understand that all things come from Him. And so it's difficult. It's not impossible, but it is difficult when you're in that position. So he says, better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. Turn to Luke chapter 3. Let's turn to the New Testament to see some of the things that are said in the New Testament about this concept. Luke chapter 3 and verse 14 says, and the soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, what shall we do? And he said unto them, do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely, and be content with your wages. Now, how many of us have ever said, you know, I don't get paid enough for what I do? I know that there's sometimes when I'm thinking it. I may not say it out loud every time, but I know I think it sometimes. I think, teachers don't get paid enough. This is terrible. You know, why can't they do better than this? And we deserve more than this. But what we hear here in the scriptures in Luke 3:14 is that we're to be content with our wages. We're to do an honest day's work and be content with our wages. Be content with that we receive from our labors. So contentment, we know, is something that's the principle is put out throughout the whole scripture. Let's turn back to Philippians, but go to chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4, because this is not the only time that Paul mentions this in the book of Philippians. Philippians chapter 4. In verse 11, not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. Now, did Paul say that just came to him naturally? That, you know what, just naturally, just in my life, I'm content wherever I am. No, that's not what he said. He said, I have learned in whatever state I am, therewith to be content. And it's something that we've all got to learn. And it's a process, and it goes against our human nature. Our human nature is not to be content with what we have. Now, I'm going to kind of play the devil's advocate here for just a minute and talk about kind of the other side of this, because there is a way that this can be damaging to us if we take it to the extreme as well. I think that any man should try to do well in his career and should want to progress and move forward and provide for his family. So I don't want you to get the idea that I'm saying, look, just don't even try. Just kind of take whatever comes your way and laissez-faire style of providing for your family. That's not what is meant by this at all. However, we need to be content. We need to work hard and do what we can and then be content with what God provides us with because we have to remember that it does come from God. So we've looked at the scriptures. We know this is definitely a scriptural principle. But what are some of the nuts and bolts that might be causing this in our country? What is it that makes us to be so discontent, even though we lived in this most indulged society of the world? Well, several sociologists, of course, have looked at that. And one of the things they come up with, and I'm not preaching sociology. I'm just telling you, I think this, even from a biblical standpoint, is probably the truth, that one reason may be small families. You look around today at the average size of the American family, and it's smaller than it's ever been, and it's steadily shrinking. Very few people have large families anymore. We don't see that much. And I think that has to do a lot with selfishness, and not in every case, but in a lot of cases, it does. The average American family, you probably remember back in the 80s and 90s hearing this statistic, that the average American family is a husband and a wife and 2.5 children. You remember that stat? Everybody always laughed about 2.5 children. That's funny, you know, it's 2.5. In fact, in my family, I had two brothers. There was three of us. And me and my older brother always kidded my little brother that he was the 0.5. You know, we're the two kids, you're the 0.5, you're only half. So that's what we've always heard in America, that it's man, wife, and 2.5 children is the average American family. Sadly to say, that's not the case anymore in more ways than one. First of all, having a man and a wife is a rare thing in today's society, that are still married and together. That is a rare thing. But then beyond that, that number has dropped. It is now 1.6 children. It dropped from 2.5 to 1.6, and it declines every year by at least a tenth. So we're headed in the next few years to be where, you know, within 6 years we could be where it's below one children per family is the average size of the American family. So this really affects, I think, our contentment. Now, my wife grew up in a family with seven children. I grew up in a church where there were several large families. Y'all know the Cannons, and there's six of them, and the Gesseth, there's a lot of them. I lose count sometimes. They had so many of them, and just many other families in that church. Brother Kevin Poe had several children, and you see in those families that each child is not doted over to the extreme. That's impossible when you have that many children, and they had to learn to be content with what they had, and I think that could be a very, very much a reason why. And like I said, but for some that's not a choice, and I'm very sensitive to that. Rebecca and I want to have a lot more children, and we hope the Lord blesses us with that. So far He has not, but we're not giving up on that. We're still praying about it, and we hope we can have many more, but as of right now, that hasn't happened. So we know that that's not a choice for everyone, but it is for many. Now, that's one reason for this discontentment in our society, but there's many others as well. Let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verses 6 through 8. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. Well, at the beginning of this, we see that godliness with contentment is great gain. That's a great statement. But then in verse 7, I think this is an important principle for all of us to understand, and too many times we forget it. You're never going to see a hearse pulling a U-Haul. It doesn't happen. Whatever, you can't carry your possessions with you when you leave this world. It's not going to happen. This world, we put so much stock in what we have and how much we gather up in our, you know, they say that, you've heard the expression too, that when you grow from a child to an adult, all that happens is your toys get more expensive. That's really the case a lot of times. You know, we put a lot of stock into the stuff that we can gather and how much money we can put in our bank account. But he says, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. You can't take it with you when you go. And we need to remember that sometimes. But then in verse 8, it says, having food and raiment, let us be there with content. Now, how many of us, if all we had in this world was just enough food for us and our family to get by, I'm not talking about a whole lot, I'm talking about enough for us to survive on. Enough food for us to survive on and some clothes to wear. If that's all we had in this world, how many of us would really truly be content with that? I don't have to ask you because I know in my own heart that steps all over my toes. I don't think I probably wouldn't be very content, and that's wrong. But we ought to be content with that, is what we hear here in this chapter in 1 Timothy 6, 6, 7, and 8, that having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. And like we said before, it's really a scourge on our society. This, and I told you this was a timely message. Well, what we're facing right now in our economy is really a unique thing. I don't want to get into politics and current events too much, but I think that the comparison needs to be drawn. What we're really facing right now is a credit crunch. It's there's a problem of liquidity, and people can't go and borrow money, and so businesses are getting behind, and people went out and borrowed more money than they could repay to try to get a bigger house than they could really afford. So you see the tie-in with this message. Like I said, people wanted more than what they could really do, and their greed has caused the nation in general a bigger problem. And so we're facing this really, what it really is a credit crunch. I had a college professor, I was a social science major, and so I had several economics classes, and he did a presentation one time at our college at night that we were all invited to go to, called The Destruction of American Society. And it was about the 20s and 30s, and when credit became available to America, when people quit paying cash for things and started saying, well, I'll take it now and then I'll pay for it later, when credit was born. He said that was the destruction of American society, and I think he's probably really onto something there. Now, of course, I listen a lot to Dave Ramsey and people like that, and you know, he, one of his mantras is that the borrower is slave to the lender, and I think that's a biblical principle. I think he's right on that, but I don't want to stand up here and sound too like that I'm talking down to people, because believe me, I owe money. I think that you know, most of us probably do, and I'm not saying that there's, you know, that you're just terrible if you do, because I think in our society you just about have to. It's the way that the society is built. But we shouldn't go out and try to get more than what we can repay. And I think that is absolutely a biblical principle, and that's part of greed and being content. We ought to be content with what God provides for us. Now, you say, well, what does all this have to do with the church and with spirituality? Well, I think the sad thing is that we would ever bring this discontentment and carry it over into the house of God. What a terrible thing that would be if we brought an attitude of discontentment and complaining and whining spirit into the church of God. And too many times we see that. The church is not doing me right, or there's just things that I don't like. And that spirit of discontentment that breeds in these outside things ends up coming into the church of God. And I think the problem with that is, we've been talking about this kind of from an outside view, but now let's really get down to the nuts and bolts. What are you doing when you're complaining and being discontent with what you have? Who are you really complaining against? Let's put it that way. Who is the provider of all of those things? Well, it's God. That's a very biblical principle. So if you say, I need this, and if I don't have this, I'm just not happy, and I'm not going to be content. Who are you really grumbling and complaining against? Is it your boss, or... No, not really. You're really, in the ultimate scheme of things, you're ultimately complaining against God, because it is God that puts you where you are and puts you in the position that you're in. It's God that did that, and we need to be thankful to Him for what He gives us and not be discontented with our lot in life, because we're complaining against Him. And I think we don't see that enough. Turn back to Philippians chapter 2 again. Philippians chapter 2. And let's read our verse again. Do all things without murmurings and disputing. Well, murmuring is kind of talking back about your situation or who you think got you there. Well, we're not to murmur against God. We're not to complain about our lot in life, because murmuring, we would be murmuring against God if that's the case. We need to understand that in that context. Turn to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5 says, let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have, for He hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Now, we look at that verse kind of in two parts. First of all, it's talking about covetousness. Let your conversation or your manner of life be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. Then here's the second part. For God hath said, for he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. So you see the tie-in that if we understand that God is going to provide for us, he said he would do it. He said he would provide for his children. And we are discontented with our lying life, then what we're saying is, I really don't believe God meant what he said. I think God was really kind of lying about that. That's really what you're saying. If we say that I'm not content and I don't have enough and I wish I had this and this and this and this in my life, and God has said, I'm never going to leave you, I'm not going to forsake you, I'm going to be there, I'm going to provide for you, then we are doubting that he is going to keep that promise. We could go to many places in the scriptures and show that. You can even go down in that next verse. The Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man shall do unto me. The concept that God provides for his children, if we are discontented, we're not believing that that's the truth. We're not believing that God is actually going to provide for us. There's a book. It's a terrible book. And I read little excerpts from it. I don't have the book. I wouldn't ever want to support it with my money. But it's a book that was very popular, and the title of the book is called Disappointment with God. And like I said, unbelievably, it's really a good seller. It sold a lot of copies. And what it does is it basically describes God as this lonely, misunderstood lover of men who it kind of encourages people to, even though you're disappointed in God, basically is the premise of the book, it encourages you not to complain against God, but rather just to love him, because he's really got your best interest at heart, and he really wants to do well for you. How terrible is that view of God? That, you know, of course we see that a lot in salvation, because that's really the difference in what we believe about salvation and what most other Christianity in this country believes about salvation, is that God is this supreme being who yet can't conquer the will of man. He just can't do it. And so he's there hoping and praying that you'll choose him. And that's, they've kind of carried that over to this practical side of things. And they're saying basically, God's trying to do the best he can in your life. And so you shouldn't you shouldn't be angry at him, but you should just kind of like somebody with sympathy, kind of have sympathy for God, because he's doing everything that he can and he's trying and he wants the best for you. That is a terrible, terrible view of God, and that makes him not God, really. God is sovereign. He orders the circumstances of our life. He's not trying to do the best he can in your life. He orders the circumstances of our lives. So to complain against him and grumble is a sin, because we believe that he not only sees the end from the beginning, but that he works in our lives to get us to that end. Turn to Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9, verses 19 and 20. And this is the same concept, but now, of course, in this particular context, we're talking about salvation. But this is right after Paul has introduced that topic and said that that the purpose of God according to election might stand, that that the elder was going to serve the younger. He says, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. So he's bringing up election here, and he says he's going to have mercy on who he's going to have mercy, compassion on who he's going to have compassion. So down in verse 19, Paul kind of knows what's going to happen. He says, thou wilt say then unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will? Nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed it say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? In other words, can we question God who created us, who made us? Can we answer back against him and say, you know what? I know better than you do. If I had this and this and this, and if I had this much money in my bank account, I would be better off. I know that. Are we really going to rise up before God and say, I know better than you? Many times we see that in the scripture. You remember Job went before God, and what did he say to Job? He said, all right, Job, I want you to stand up like a man, and I want you to answer this question for me then. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? Where were you when this happened? And he made Job answer, and of course, that was a big dose of humility for Job, and I think many times we need that same medicine. Turn to Jude 16, though, because we'll see here in Jude 16 why this is so important. Because this sin of murmuring and complaining against God and not being content is a characteristic sin of the wicked. Jude verse 16, Let's actually go up to verse 15 to get the context. To execute judgment upon all, and to convince all that are ungodly among them of their ungodly deeds, which they have ungodly committed, and all their hard speeches which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. So I think it's pretty plain from that verse. We're talking about ungodly people. He says it about four times in the same verse. He says, these are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lust, and their mouths speaketh great swelling words, having men's persons in admiration because of advantage. Now, do you see the principle here? He says, one of the characteristics of these ungodly people is that they're murmurers and complainers. They're walking after their own lust. Their mouths speak these great swelling words. They have men's persons in admiration because of advantage, because they are rich, because they are well thought of, because they have great possessions. That is a characteristic sin of the wicked. So we absolutely want to avoid that. I don't think any of us in here would want to be placed in the group that is mentioned in verse 15. It says that they are ungodly among him of their ungodly deeds, they're ungodly committed, their hard speeches which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. I don't think we want to be in that. We don't want to be in that group. And he says one of the characteristics of that group is these are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lust. So we definitely don't want to be in that group. So our whole first side of our discussion today is that we don't want to complain and murmur and be not content with where we are. So we said at the very beginning, back at the very beginning of the message, that we wanted to have a dissatisfied contentment. And what we've done is we've looked at the second half of that first. We've looked at contentment, being content. That's one of the attributes that we're to have as children of God. We're to be content. So now we're going to look at the other side of that, that we need to have dissatisfied contentment. And that really is a hard thing to do many times, to have a dissatisfied Christian life. We've been talking about this contented Christian life. So does that mean that we're just to sit back and just kind of cruise, just kind of put it on cruise control and coast and just be content with whatever comes our way? Like I said, kind of a laissez-faire attitude about life. Well, that's not what the Scripture teaches either. Turn to Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3, and we'll see. And Paul's actually going to go into more detail about this in the next little part of our chapter there in chapter 2. But let's look at Philippians 3, verses 12 through 14 first. Not as though I had already attained, either were already perfect, but I follow after, if that I may apprehend that for which I am apprehended of Christ Jesus. Brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth into those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Now, there's some confusing language in that. But what Paul is saying there is, I don't think I've already got there. I don't think I'm to the point where I can just kind of lay back and cruise. He says, because Christ has made me his own, because he's apprehended me, then I'm going to reach out, I'm going to press on, and I'm going to try to apprehend that which he's laid before me. So what Paul is saying is, don't be satisfied with where you are in your walk with God. Yes, be content with where God has placed you as far as your finances and those kinds of things. Be content with that. Be content with those things such as you have. But don't be content with your walk with God. Don't say, you know what, I'm kind of doing all right. I can just kind of cruise. Paul does not say, because I'm secure, therefore I coast. That's not what the text says. He says, because I'm secure, because I've been apprehended, I press towards the mark. I work harder. I try to move forward in my sanctification, in my becoming conformed to the image of Christ. We need to be content with such things as we have, but yet we need to be dissatisfied with the level of sin that we see in our life. That's what we mean by a dissatisfied contentment. We're dissatisfied with how much that we're like Christ. We're dissatisfied with all of those things that we see in our life where we could be closer to God, the sin that we could root out and mortify those deeds of the flesh. Back in Philippians 2, verse 12, if you remember, that's what we were talking about when he said, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, to do those things, to show that work. And so when we say be content, we don't mean sit down and do nothing. We mean that we're content with what we have, but we're dissatisfied with our level of commitment to Christ. So let's just kind of sum it all up in closing. What Paul is saying here, let's go back to kind of verse 12 and start there. If you look at Philippians chapter 2, verse 12, I'm going to kind of summarize verse 12 and 13 and 14. Paul says, first of all, don't be satisfied. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Live the dissatisfied Christian life. Constantly be pressing towards the mark. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Then he says in verse 13, understand, though, that it's God's work in you. It's not that you're doing this of your own accord. It's the power of the Holy Spirit working in you that allows you to do that. And then he says in the last, in 2:14, he says, and be content with what you have. Don't be satisfied with your life first. It's God that worketh in you, but then you need to be content with that work and what God has provided for you. So we want a dissatisfied contentment. Now, I also don't want it to sound like I already mentioned a couple of times, like I'm speaking from an area where I've got it all figured out. If you were to see my checkbook, you'd know I don't have it all figured out financially in my life. We're doing the best that we can, and I know many of you are, but I think we've always got room for improvement. And if the culture of this, and I also don't want it to sound like I'm down on America and that we're just this terrible place, that's absolutely not what I believe either. However, if we're going to change this culture, I can tell you how it's going to change. It's going to be that Christians, that churches retake their place in society and speak into the culture like we used to in years past. And we teach biblical principles to our children who go out and live those biblical principles in their life. That's what's going to change this society. So I pray that we'll be able to do that. May God bless you is my prayer.